So everybody should have source sheets, printed extra copies this time. Starting off, thanks to Karen and Jake Abelevitz for sponsoring this morning's Locks and Learn. Lulu Nishmas, Jake's parents, Eliyahu ben Abba and Leah Bas Avram, and Karen's brother, Yoshua ben Shimon Dov, Nirshama should have an Aliyah. The Shirim from Tisha B'Av are posted on YU Torah, so if you did not see them, if you're not here or you didn't see them on Facebook, we stream them live. But in addition to that, they're on YU Torah, so if you want to catch up on those, they're relevant to the context of Pirkei Avos, but if you miss them, don't worry, you should be able to hold on to these Shirim as well. Next week, the goal is, Mirtz Hashem, we're going to finish the first parak of Pirkei Avos. So we are now up to the 16th Mishnah. We have two more to go after today, and hopefully we're going to be finishing those both up next week. We will then take a two-week break until September 3rd. September 3rd is Labor Day weekend. We'll pick back up then with the second parak, but we're going to take a little bit of a hiatus. I'm going to be away for a little bit, and then pick back up September 3rd. I know some of you are not going to be here next week, so just remember that that's going to be, next week is the last week until September 3rd. Okay, so let's jump into the shiur. Some background points. Last week, we saw a progression of leadership from Hillel to his son Shimon, who we mentioned in the whole crux of last week's shiur, is that there is no Mishnah in the name of Shimon, the son of Hillel, and what that meant and what that signified, I refer you back to last week. Shimon's son, we are going to be dealing with today, that's Rabban Gamliel. And then his son is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel will be speaking about, we spoke a little bit about him on Tisha B'Av, but we'll speak about him in more detail next week. The last two Mishnayos are his. We are going to turn to Rabban Gamliel, who, just to be clear, there's lots of Rabban Gamliels in the Gemara. Okay, so it gets a little confusing, and it's important to clarify who we're talking about. This Rabban Gamliel is usually referred to Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, the elder, to distinguish him from his grandson, who's known as just Rabban Gamliel. Most of the stories that we're familiar with the name Rabban Gamliel is probably about his son, who we'll get to in later months. And then there's even more Rabban Gamliels down the line. They just keep using the name over and over and over again. So this is Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Rabban Gamliel the Elder. So I'm going to spoil some of the suspense and intrigue that sometimes we have in the buildup of this year. And I'm going to do that in order that it makes it easier to follow the sources. So I'm going to give away some of the punchline in order that we can understand as we go forward a little bit better. So as we go through the sources, I want us to keep in mind three recurring themes that we have seen, I would say throughout is an exaggeration, but a number of times over the course of the Pirkei Avos Shirim. And those three themes are going to be important in understanding Rabban Gamliel. The first theme is that of sages versus priests. So the Chachamim as opposed to the Kohanim. On Tisha B'Av, we spoke about this at great length. We're not going to spend that much time on it today, but I am going to reference it. So I just want to point out that we have this tension between the sages and the priests. The priests, the Kohanim, were not your classic Aaron HaKohens of days of yore. These were Kohanim who presented problems for the rabbis. Again, we've touched at length on Tisha B'Av. We'll make mention of it briefly in this year as we go forward. The two other points which are more central that have come up in the past is that if you remember from Rabban Gamliel's grandfather, who is Hillel, when we spoke about Hillel, there is a tension, if you want to call it that, as to where you want to emphasize when deciding halachot. Do you emphasize tradition, that I make decisions, I make psak based on precedent, that I need to know that this law has been transmitted from generation to generation? Or can I also, and to what extent, if I am allowed to, emphasize innovation, creativity, the use of logic in deciding certain halachot? So that was a tension with Hillel. As we go forward, I'm going to actually re-reference the specific source about Hillel, but just keep this idea in mind. Creativity, innovation versus tradition. And the third recurring theme is similar, but on a slightly different note. If you remember from the Shirim about Shimon ben Shetach. So Shimon ben Shetach was a controversial figure, and I remember we had some debates afterwards going on about whether or not what he did was appropriate or not appropriate. But if you remember, the main thing about those Shirim about Shimon ben Shetach is that he strengthened the legal system to the point where we thought in certain cases were just extreme. If you remember, the indication was that his son was actually killed based on false testimony, and he refused to overturn, he wanted to, his son actually convinced him not to, to overturn the ruling because we have to follow the halachic process. And what we learned from Shimon ben Shetach was the importance of a Beis Din, the importance of the rabbis to be a central legal authority in order to promote stability in the era. That was 100 to 150 years preceding what we're talking about now. But the recurring theme to think about is the role of centralized Beis Din, of Beis Din being able to enforce and create rules that may be controversial, but that we're going to follow, or at least they're going to promote and hope that we follow regardless. So those are our three recurring themes: sages versus priests, creativity versus tradition, and the authority of Beis Din. One more preamble, the historical background. When is this taking place? So let's try to figure this out from what we know already. When did Hillel live? So Hillel was born around, and I'm not sure if we can date these accurately completely, but according to Wikipedia at least, in 110 BC, and he died in, according to Wikipedia, in 10 CE. Okay? So he lives a decent amount of time. That spans, that's 120 years. So 120 years. He lives a really long time. His students, Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, the first generation, we pinpointed last week at around the time of the turn of the millennium, maybe a little bit before that. So maybe let's date that. Again, these are estimates. Let's say 50 BCE to around zero-ish is the first generation of Hillel, Beis Hillel, and Beis Shammai. That's where Hillel's son was the Nasi. That's around that's absence from the Mishnayos, right? And now we're moving to the next generation. We're just going to estimate that it's around the turn of the millennia, going forward a little bit, according to Wikipedia also. Again, there's no, in the Gemara, you're not going to find these sources. You're not going to find exactly when somebody died, what year they died. So there's various historical possibilities. I'm not saying it's conclusive at all. They cite their sources, I think, for when Rabban Gamliel died, they actually source a Christian historical source. Remember, this is the period where Christianity comes into the fore. There's actually some Christians actually argue. Again, I'm not saying this is true. It's not. But they argue that Rabban Gamliel actually converted to Christianity. So they're actually very interested in him. So they do. So in their sources, they actually talk a lot about him. And so that's why I'm not saying when exactly he died. But it's around, it makes sense that it's around that time period. Around 50, they dated as 52 CE is when he died. Pre-destruction. He dies before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which is in 70 CE. So he's around this time period. So let's date it just for simplicity's sake. From the turn of the millennia to around 50 CE, this is when he is in his ruling state. And that's important, because what we're going to see is that this is a gap, a bridge, in between two, I would call, almost chaotic eras. If you remember from last week, the era of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, all of that fighting, and there was really no centralized leader, that was before Rabban Gamliel. And then after Rabban Gamliel is when the destruction happens. And again, we spoke about this on Tisha B'Av, about a vacuum to some extent in some of the leadership when it came to the destruction of the temple. So here he has the power, and we're going to see he does use this period of peace in between. So historically, from the Roman perspective, so Herod dies in 4 BCE, and from 4 BCE till around 26 CE, the Romans were in charge, but they were actually not too bad to us. And they let us do what we wanted, and there was no real persecution. And 26 is when Pontius Pilate comes and starts ruling as a Roman governor, and then things go downhill from there. But you have this gap, and I think this is important. I didn't see anybody make this direct connection, but from putting everything together, I think it makes sense that when we're going to see all of these rulings and the state of centrality of the Basin during this time, it's almost like it's a peaceful period. And if that's the case, I think it makes sense to date the central reign of Rabbi Gamliel around this time period. Between the turn of the millennia to around 25 CE is when there's peace outside and we're able to create a system internally as well. It's a little bit of the background. Now let's jump into the actual sources. So if you look in the Mishnah Sota, source number one. So the Mishnah Sota at the end of Sota has it's a beautiful ending of the Mishnayos where it goes through all of these rabbis and leaders of the Jewish people, and it says, when they died, X, Y, or Z stopped from being in existence. Right? So when they died, it's like, you know, all the flowers stopped blooming. It's basically a statement of mourning about how things changed after these leaders died. Each one has a specific thing related to them. So when it comes to Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken, it says, Mishameis Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken, I think this sums up how we view him historically in the religious tradition, Batel Kavod HaTorah. Now all of a sudden, there's no more respect or honor for Torah. Meaning that he was a symbol and he inspired Kavod HaTorah, honor for the Torah. Once he dies, it's no longer there. Umesa Tahara Uprishas. As well, with him went purity and abnegation. There was just no more separation. There was no more extra added level of holiness. So we respect him. This is a pretty big figure within Jewish tradition, Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken. So let's see a little bit about where this comes from. So we're going to see a bunch of Mishnayos. He is featured in a lot of Mishnayos throughout of Shas. And for source number two, I'm going to give you a little bit of a background. So let's go back to that case of Hillel. So you remember Hillel, Rabbi Gamliel's grandfather, was once asked, can we bring a Korban Pesach on Shabbos? So we did this around 3 or 4 weeks ago. Can we bring a Korban Pesach on Shabbos? And Hillel brought out all of these, he's from Babel, and now he's in Eretz Yisrael, and they're not used to this type of learning. Hillel all of a sudden brings out all of these arguments using logic, using Kal Vachomers, and using all these different types of logical arguments as to why you're allowed to bring a Korban Pesach on Shabbos. And they're blown away because they're used to this more of a traditional, we pass on rulings from generation to generation, and here they couldn't remember what the ruling was, and Hillel innovates through logic to create and reinforce the ruling. What happens next? Anybody remember? They ask him another question. They ask him, okay, so you're allowed to bring it on Shabbos, but what do I do if I forget the knife? Okay, so please don't turn it off. If you can make it a little bit higher, make it a little bit higher. Okay, it's very hard to regulate and modulate. Please bring your sweaters. Okay, so they ask him, what do we do if we forget the knife? Can we bring the knife on Shabbos? Can I carry the knife to do the slaughter? And he says, I don't remember. And he couldn't figure out how to answer this question. And then he says, it's okay, I trust the people that they will remember. And then he sees, what did they do? They put the knife in the sheep's wool, and the sheep carried it in its wool. And Hillel says, now I remember that tradition from my teacher, Shmaya and Atalion, that's what you're supposed to do. that case, that story, I think is a good example of that tension between creation and innovation, and then also having to rely on tradition when the creation and the innovation fails you. So you need this balance to some extent. Now, with that background, the next source has another similar case with Rabban Gamliel. And this has to do with the concept of peah. So what's the concept of peah? So if I'm growing, let's say, wheat in my field, I have to leave a corner of my field for poor people to be able to take that food. So now, here's the question that Rabbi Shimon of Mitzpah asks Rabban Gamliel. Let's say I have two types of wheat that I'm growing in the same, let's say, same field, same area. It's two separate, distinct types of wheat. Do I have to leave two corners or just one corner? So Shimon HaMitzvah asks Rabban Gamliel, and let's look inside. Ma'isa Shazara is the source number two. Ma'isa Shazara Rab Shimon Ish HaMitzvah Lifnei Rabban Gamliel Ba'alu L'lishkas HaGazus V'shalu. So apparently Rabban Gamliel, he asked Rabban Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel didn't know the answer. And they have to go to the L'lishkas HaGazus, so they go to the temple to ask the rabbis there, V'shalu. And they asked, Amar Nachum HaLavlar. So Nachum HaLavlar answers this question. Is there anybody here of Nachum HaLavlar before? No. So we have Rabban Gamliel here, who's this really the powerful sage of the time. He doesn't know the answer, and I'm sure if we lived at the time, we would have known who Nachum HaLavlar is. But the point here is that if you're going to compare, at least historically, who's had more impact on the Jewish people, right? It's going to be Rabban Gamliel. Nachum HaLavlar is sort of like, unless you remember this Mishnah, you don't really know who he is. So Nachum HaLavlar says, Mekubal ani, I have a tradition. Mi Rebbe, mi Yosha, Shekubal, mi Abba. So he, from Rebbe Ma'asha, who accepts this, who got this tradition from his father, that accepted it from the pears, that accepted it from the Nevi'im, who got it from Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. This goes all the way back to Moses. Halacha L'Moshe M'Sinai. That what's the law? Bezorea esadeu, shnei minei chitin. If you do your field with two different types of wheat, im asa an goren achas, nosen peah achas. If you collect it, it matters how you collect it. If you collect it and bring it to the threshing floor as one, then you only have to separate one peah. Shtei granos, nosen shtei peah. But if you have two separate sort of warehouses for this, storehouses, and you're bringing it to two separate places, then you have to have two separate peahs for those two separate types of wheat. Important for now is not the peah necessarily, but the fact that, how does he answer this question? He gives you a tradition that dates back, that's rock solid all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. And as you read this, you're reminded of the beginning of Pirkei Avos. Right, Moshe kibal Torah Misina, Masu Yeshua, Shulis Kames, Kenim Neviim, Neviim Masu Lanshe Knesset Sagadola. There's a tradition that dates back and dates back and dates back. Rabbi Gamliel apparently didn't have this tradition, and apparently also wasn't able to create or innovate the halacha from just logical examples. So Rabbi Gamliel, who had, presumably at this stage was still Rabbi Gamliel, right? He was being asked the question, couldn't answer. Because he didn't have that tradition, and he had to go back to the people who had the tradition.
Excuse me, did anybody
yeah.
ever go to Beis Shammai for any question?
I'm sure the Beis Shammai people went to Beis Shammai. Again, that's a broader question. We did speak somewhat about it last week, not in detail, but there are sources that say during that time period, you actually had a choice. And you could either follow Beis Hillel or Beis Shammai, and you could choose, you just can't mix and match to your own.
But once it is Beis Shammai,
presumably that's correct, yes. And you also can't ask, like, oh, I know Beis Hillel is Mekel over here, so I'm going to ask him that question. And then Beis Shammai is Mekel over here, so I'm going to ask Beis Shammai that question. So it explicitly says you're not allowed to do that. So there is a source, not in any classic early sources, I think it's dated later in the medieval times, that says that when Beis Shammai, when Mashiach comes, we'll follow Beis Shammai. Again, it's not rooted in old sources. I don't know exactly we could talk about what the meaning of that is, and but for now let's put it aside. Right. Yeah. So good point, but let's put that to the side for a second. Now, so that we're gonna build on this concept of tradition versus innovation as we go along, because we're gonna see that Rabban Gamliel is an innovator. And he's gonna innovate a lot. Now look at part 3, the priest. This is just a side point, but I think important. There's another source in Chazal, this is from Maseches Sofrim, where it says, this gives us a little picture about who Rabbi Gamliel was, and it also gives us, at least from an inference, as to the tension between the sages and the priests. So it says, Ma'aseh Rav Chalavta Shehalach Lefnei Rabbi Gamliel. So Rav Chalavta goes in front of Rabbi Gamliel, Umatzu Yoshev Al Shulchano, Uviyado Targum Shel Iyov. So this is Rabbi Gamliel, the grandson. So Rabbi Gamliel, the grandson, is sitting and learning Iyov, a translation of Iyov, by a korbo. He was reading it, he was learning it. Amar Lo, Hirshani Lomar Masher Ra'u Einai. So Rav Chalavta says to Rabbi Gamliel, the grandson, do you allow me permission to recite, to tell you what I saw with my own eyes, what I witnessed myself? Amar Lo Emor. So Rabbi Gamliel, the grandson, says, yes, please, say it. Amar Lo. He says to him, Sofa Yisi Rabbi Gamliel Azakein Avi Avicha. I saw your grandfather, Rabbi Gamliel the elder, Shai Yoshev Agave Abinyon Bahar Abayit. So he was sitting on Har Abayit. So he was sitting, I don't know what he was doing there. Maybe he was learning. Maybe he was posking questions. But he was on Har Abayis. They view the fun of Targum Shel Iyov. They brought to him a translation of Iyov. And remember, Rabbi Gamliel, the grandson, is learning a translation of Iyov. So he's trying to prove a point here. He says, I saw your grandfather, and he was sitting, posking shilas, and answering questions, and somebody brought to him a translation of Iyov. And what did he do with this translation? The Amar Libana'in, he told the builders. Remember, who's building the Beis HaMikdash now? So Herod is a little bit earlier than this, presumably. Maybe not. It depends when we date this case. Presumably Herod already died, maybe. But either way, remember we mentioned last week and we mentioned on Tisha B'Av, the reconstruction and the renovations went on until the year 64 CE. So these renovations are going on for a really long time. So there are builders there. He tells the builders, Salku es ashura, remove one of these layers of brick, v'shaku zeh tachtav, and bury this underneath the brick. Right? So you never know. Like maybe you'll go, one of those letters in the Kotel is actually one of this translation of Iyov. But the story here, for our purposes, there's a lot of things to take out of this. For our purposes, I think it's interesting, and Rabbi Lau makes this point, is that who's overseeing this construction? It's the sages, right? If I would have asked you who would oversee construction in the Beis HaMikdash, first guess would be the Kohan. At least ideally, this is their territory. But here, no, it's the sages who are in charge of the construction. He makes one other point in this context that I haven't mentioned in the past, I think is interesting, when it talks about Hillel. So what does Hillel say? Who should you be like? Havu mitalmidei Aaron HaKohen. Ohav Shalom Rodev Shalom. Should be like the students of Aaron HaKohen. What should have it said? If you wanted to emulate this Aaron gene, if you will, it should have said, be like the sons of Aaron, meaning the Kohanim. But they weren't, exactly, here's the point, is that the Kohanim at the time were not our role models. At the time, now things have changed. So the Kohanim at the time were not our role models. And because of that, he makes this inference and this diuk that I think is interesting. It doesn't say, be like the children of Aaron. It says, be like the students of Aaron. Okay? So again, another point, and we've dealt with this in the past, and we dealt with it on Tisha B'Av. We're going to put it to the side for now. I just want you to realize here that this is another case of perhaps this tension between sages and priests. Next part, part four, in terms of authority. Here we're starting to see where Rabbi Gamliel, and at the end we're going to see how all of this ties into what he says in Pirkei Avos. Here we're starting to see his authority. So it's a case here, it's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and the Gemara says, we're going to read this one in English just to save some time for now. So it once happened that Rabbi Gamliel was sitting on a step of the Temple Hill. Again, this is apparently where he hung out. He hung out on the Temple Hill. And well-known scribe Yochanan, so there's a scribe named Yochanan, was standing before him, and there were three sheets there. And Rabbi Gamliel tells him, I want you to write the following three letters. And the point of these letters, we don't have to know all the various details, it gets a little bit technical, but the main point here is that he's in charge of informing all of the communities throughout Eretz Yisrael, as well as in the diaspora, as to various rulings of the Beis Din and the Sanhedrin that were going on in Yerushalayim. So Rabbi Gamliel is respected that when your community needed to know something, he was the one who was signing that letter. So what are the three things, just briefly? So he says, take one sheep and write a letter to our brethren in the upper Galilee and to those in the lower Galilee, saying, may your peace be great. So that's a nice introduction. We beg to inform you that the time of removal has arrived for setting aside the tithe from the olive heaps. And we're not going to get into the details here, but basically, there's a certain point in time within the Trumos and Maestros cycle when you have to tithe that you have to take out all of your stuff and burn it. That happens at a certain time period, and Rabbi Gamliel here is telling them, sending them a letter, that time is now. And then you see in source number two, which is interesting also geographically, so it's in the Galil that it's the olives, but then when you go more towards the south, take another sheet and write to our brethren of the south, may your peace be great. We beg to inform you that the time of the removal has arrived by setting aside the tithe of the corn sheaves. Right? So just remember, not everybody's growing the same things. There's different geographical locations where it's in the north it's good to grow olives, and in the south it's good to grow corn, depending on the land, etc. And then finally, this is going to transition us to the next few sources, not just in terms of the time for the tithes, but in terms of what else is an important function of the Beis Din, creating the calendar, the leap year. When do we add a new month that we have a Adar Sheni? So now it's all later, not during this time period. A few hundred years later, 150, 200 years later, I don't know exactly when, but they created a centralized system where we don't have to rely on Beis Din, and that's why now you can predict, you know when there's going to be a full month, a month that's only 29 days, a month that's 30 days, when do we add the leap year? Back then it wasn't formalized every year. Every year you had to do it by year. Are we going to add a month or are we not going to add a month? Is this going to be a 29-day month or is this going to be a 30-day month? That was a really important function of the Beis Din. Because remember, all of our holidays are based on that. Right? So, Lezer and Freddie, the case that you always bring up, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Gamliel, the grandson of this Rabbi Gamliel, is going to fight with Rabbi Yeshua in a good 50, 75 years down the road in terms of when is Yom Kippur. Rabbi Yeshua is going to say it's on this day. Rabbi Gamliel says it's going to be on the other day. And Rabbi Gamliel, the grandson who was in charge at that time, made Yehoshua, Rabbi Yeshua, come on the day that Rabbi Yeshua thought was Yom Kippur with his wallet and his working clothes to show him that I am the authority of proving when is the right month. Now, with that context, let's back up to Grandpa and see that he's also in charge now, and the Beis Din is in charge of creating and determining when these months are going to be calculated. When do we add? When do we not add? So this third part here, he says, take the third letter and write to our brethren, the exiles of Babylon, and to those in Medea, and to all those in other exiled sons of Israel, saying, may your peace be great forever. Now, just notice that the other two, it said, may your peace be great. They get, may your peace be great forever. I don't know what that signifies. But we beg to inform you that the doves are still tender and the lambs still too young, and that the crops are not yet ripe. And therefore, it seems advisable to me and to my colleagues to add 30 days to this year. Because of the agriculture of the time, because we weren't ready, we still needed a little bit more time before Nisan gets along, we're going to add another month. So here he's adding a month and sending that letter to the Gulfs. Now we're building a little bit more. We're adding another step. We just built to authority to show how he can rule over and make decisions. Now we're going to add to the innovation. And in order to do this, we're going to see briefly three fascinating sources. All three of these sources need to be understood in more detail, which we will not do now, in terms of exactly how this works, the parameters and the mechanisms for how Rabbi Gamliel was allowed to do what we're about to read. Because he's about to do some pretty crazy stuff in terms of breaking from classical tradition. There's many books and explanations that have been written as to how he was allowed to do it. For our purposes now, we just want to show and see that he was able to do it. And to remember, who's his grandfather? Hillel. What innovation did Hillel do We did not speak about this. What innovation did Hillel do that was crazy in a certain sense? That circumvented various biblical laws. Prosbul. Right? So he created, we're not going to go into the details now, but we have a precedent where Hillel used a prosbul in order to get around the fact that during the Shemitah years, really the money cannot be returned. If I gave you a loan, you're after Shemitah, you're not allowed to give that money back, and I'm not allowed to accept it back. Through prosbul, Hillel is able to, through legal parameters, able to circumvent that law. So this is his grandfather, and let's see what Rabbi Gamliel does following in that leaf. These are three Mishnayos, one in Rosh Hashanah, one in Yevamos, one in Gittin. The one in Rosh Hashanah is a little bit less difficult to swallow because it's just removing a rabbinic injunction of the concept of tchum. On Shabbos, assuming there's no Erev, there's a limit to how much you're allowed to walk past the Erev. Assuming there's no Erev, you have to put some matzahs on the floor, maybe you can walk another 2,000 amos, but there's really just 2,000 amos. There's a certain distance that you're allowed to walk past the city. And the question here, circling back to the importance of creating the new months and that responsibility of Beis Din, one second more, and that responsibility of Beis Din to create new months. So let's say somebody sees and can testify about the new moon and it's Shabbos. Right, so they have to now go and testify. We want them to come and testify, but it's Shabbos. So there's a limit to how much they're allowed to walk. So we say that they're allowed to walk to Yerushalayim, and they're allowed to stay in the place where they're going to testify in order that we keep this rule, this whole system in place. But now what happens when they get there? Where are they allowed to go? And according to the law, they're not allowed to go farther than 2,000 amos. They're stuck there. They're stuck there. So Rabbi Gamliel says that's going to cause a problem. Because, and to give you a muscle, to give you a way of thinking about this, Hatzalah, right? So Hatzalah is allowed to drive on Shabbos because it's Pikuach Nefesh. So the Hatzalah picks you up, and then they drive you to Maimonides,
and they can't leave.
And then they're stuck. They can't leave. So what's going to happen if that's technically the real rule? They shouldn't be allowed to drive back. They're not saving anybody's life. But there are tshuvas that say that if I create the system where I'm making these Hatzalah drivers go to Maimonides and then stay there for Shabbos, what's going to happen? They're not going to hear that call that often. Oh, maybe. Hopefully they would because they're such tzaddikim, and they are. But maybe there would be less incentive to go and help people. So therefore, there are rules that say that we allow them to come back, depending on, you have to know the context, etc. But that's the general rule. So now with that in mind, so what does he do? So these people are coming, and they're stuck there. So Rabbi Gamliel, in source number 5, says, again, the Mishnah says there was a large court in Jerusalem called Beit Ya'azak. There all the witnesses used to assemble, and the Beis Din used to examine them. They used to entertain them lavishly, so they had some entertainment. I don't know, they had magicians, I don't know what they had, but they entertained them somehow, there so that they should have an they lots and learn, that's what they did, so that they have an incentive to come. Originally, they used to not leave the place the whole day. They were stuck in that place. I don't even think they had the 2,000 amos. Rabbi Gamliel the Elder introduced a rule that they could go 2,000 cubits from it in any direction. These were not the only ones to the concession was made. So I misspoke before. The original rule was that you were stuck in that room. And Rabbi Gamliel said, now I'm allowing you to leave 2,000 amos in any direction. So he changes, for the purpose of creating the system and keeping the system intact, he changes the law. But that's only a rabbinic law, it's not such a big deal. Source number 6 and 7, he goes even further and creates even more innovations in order for the betterment of society. Yeah, so that again, so yes, there's tons in terms of Hillel, in terms of all of these things that are Gamliel, we can spend weeks discussing within halacha, because we're never allowed to go without halacha. And it's the same thing in terms of the innovation versus the tradition. Even the innovation is within halacha. So there's again, much ink has been spilled to explain how this is within halacha as well. We're just going to take it for granted now that that's true. Okay. So innovation is you can't just innovate whatever you want. Innovation is within it's within the Masorah, it's within the tradition. Correct. Thank you for clarifying that. So source number six, Rabbi Akiva said that he actually, this theme is running through, he went down to Naradea to intercalate the years. This is all based on, all the context here is creating the lunar system. And he met Nehemiah of Beit Deli, who said to me, I don't think that's a restaurant, but that'd be a good name. Beit Deli. So he said to him that he heard that no one in the land of Israel, with the exception of Yehuda ben Bava, permits a married woman to marry again on the evidence of one witness. So basically, a little bit of background. So usually for anything, if you want to testify in court, you need two witnesses. You need two witnesses. That's sort of basics. When it comes to if an Aguna case, where somebody, this is a classic Aguna case, not the sort of way Agunas have been used nowadays, which is men just not giving gets to their wives, or sometimes women not accepting gets from their husbands. This is a case of the classic Aguna case is the person's missing. We don't know if they're dead or not. So really, I should have to know, and this happened in the World Trade Center, there was a lot of Aguna tshuvas written about this. In terms of the real rule, the Torah, Sukkim, say you need two Eidim. And here we have Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, and as we'll see in the Mishnah, Rabbi Gamliel Hazakin, who say that we permit a woman to remarry if only one witness, and even if it's not a classically credible witness, so even a slave, let's say, who's not allowed to testify, or even a woman's not allowed to testify in court either, in Jewish court. So we would accept the testimony of anybody who's even not allowed to usually testify in court, and we would accept testimony of them, even if they're one, and even if it's one person who says, this person, I saw them die, we then allow the woman to remarry based on that. Again, that's pretty crazy, because from a classic perspective, you need two Eidim. Again, how you do this halakhically within the rules, we can do. We'll set up a Gemara share and we'll go through it in detail. But there's many things, many explanations as to how this happens. But for our purposes here, is that in order for him to do this even within the system, somebody who's just a traditionalist is not going to do this. Right? Somebody who says, I'm only going to do something, and we'll see this later on in the future Shirim, that there are certain people who say, I will never do anything unless my Rebbe did it. This isn't Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel innovates. Hold the questions for a second. Rabban Gamliel innovates. Rabban Gamliel, in order for the betterment of society. We don't want agunas. We don't want. This is a tragedy. And because we assume that the person's not going to be lying, because one of this to get to one of the reasons is because presumably I'm not going to risk testifying falsely if it's something that will come out to be eventually, right? I'm not going to testify. I saw this person die. If I'm not pretty positive that this person died, because next week he's going to knock on the door, I'm like, I thought you saw that guy die. Like, what happened? So that's part of it, but it's a larger discussion. Let's see one more source, and then I'll pause. Then I will not pause for questions, and we're going to continue. We'll pause for questions at the end. We're sort of short on time. So source number seven here is just one more case of this type of idea where the rule was that if somebody sent a get to his wife, so if she was in a different town, so I can send a shaliach to do that, I can send a messenger. And the rule was that, I'm not sure how it makes sense, that I could cancel that messenger and say, I no longer want to give that get to my wife. But the messenger is 2 weeks away, he doesn't have cell phones, he doesn't know where anything is, so he goes, delivers the get to the wife, but I, in my town, from my home, I decided in front of the basement to say, I annul the get. It's a bad system because that person's not going to, she thinks she's divorced. She's really not divorced. She's going to get remarried. Legally, you're allowed to do that. Rabbi Gamliel steps in and says, no, you are not allowed to annul a get unless you are in front of your wife. Right?
So
she has to be there. And now, so that this is a important statement to think about the ramifications of this. Because let's say Rabbi Gamliel makes this psak. He says that this is true. Now the wife has to be there. But let's say I don't listen to rabbis, right? So I send the get to my wife, and then I change my mind, and I don't go, and I cancel it, not in front of my wife. So what happens then? Before Rabbi Gamliel, That get is no longer a get. The wife is not divorced. Now, after Rabban Gamliel, what's the power of this statement? Is this a get or is it not a get?
Yes, it's a get.
But he's not in front of his wife.
But he's not in front of his wife. But the original law is that it would be a get. So the power of this statement is that it's not a get. It is a get. That's what I meant. It is a get. It is a get. You cannot cancel. Even if you cancel it, it doesn't count. Your canceling doesn't count because of the authority of Rabban Gamliel. Because of the authority of the Beis Din. It overpowers what was the law beforehand. And this is not no simple, this is no simple matter. We're talking about who's allowed to marry who. Right? So with these examples, and we brought these three, you see that Rabban Gamliel isn't just a traditionalist. He does obviously follow tradition, and he does, even when he innovates, it's within tradition, it's within halacha, but there's a tremendous amount that he is instituting for the betterment of society. With all of this together, now let's see his statement in Pirkei Avos. Source number 8. So Rabbi Gamliel says, Aseh lecha rav. Everybody see it? The top of the left, I think it's the third page. Aseh lecha rav, make for yourself a rabbi. V'histalek min hasafek, remove yourself from doubt. V'al tarbe la'aser umadot, you should not make a habit of tithing by guesswork. Now, we're going to break this down a little bit. I'm not sure we're going to get to every detail right now. What exactly that means, let's see if we have time. But I want to start to first pull it together before we break down the Mishnah a little bit more. So number one, Aseh lecha rav. Anybody remember that from beforehand?
Yes.
We had somebody say that already. So perhaps, I'm not sure we're going to deal with that today. Maybe we'll save some time for next week. Why is he repeating something that somebody said beforehand? Histalik min hasafek, remove yourself from doubt. And then don't tithe by guessing, by estimating. So let's see how Rabbi Lau pulls this all together. So the next source here, Rabbi Binyamin Lau in the Book of Sages, remove yourself from doubt. So he goes through the sources that we just went through, and he concludes with the following summary and explanation. Rabbi Gamliel sought to unify the people under the authority of the sages. His rule heralds the beginning of the Tannaitic period, so the Tannaim begin now, the era of the pairs, the Zugos, which ended with Hillel and Shammai. So that pair has ended, and we have entered a period of wide-ranging disputes and continued conflict. Remember last week, Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai. Someone was needed to unite the powers that be in order to prevent the bifurcation of the Torah from becoming, quote-unquote, two Torahs, which it did become in that right before him, as we mentioned last week with Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, and of Jewish society. Rabbi Gamliel, incidentally, the first to be known at the title Rabban, which will become important either later or the beginning of next week when we finish up this last point, assumed this responsibility. Two missions confronted him. Firstly, he had to maintain and perpetuate the tradition of creativity instituted by his grandfather, enabling the renewal of the Torah in a manner that addressed the dynamic needs of the generation. You need to be able to innovate within Torah in order to address the population in front of you. Secondly, continuing, he had to ensure the universal Jewish acceptance of the Torah in its entirety. For example, an annual calendar not universally adhered to was worthless. Had nobody complied with his enactment prohibiting a husband from canceling a get, what power would have he had? The secret to the sages' power lay in their ability to combine these two factors, creativity and authority. Now bringing it to Pirkei Avos, acquire a teacher for yourself and remove yourself from doubt. The failure of the students of Shammai and Hillel to properly serve their teachers resulted in the proliferation of disputes, which stifled progress, brought confusion, and a general lack of direction. Addressing this problem, Rabbi Gamliel centralized and stressed rabbinic authority, preventing its development along multiple tracks, streamlining the entire system, and channeling it toward defined horizons devoid of doubt. Aseh lecha rav, you have to have a central authority. You need a rabbi. You need a government of a chazal, a Sanhedrin, etc., to create rules that we have to follow, and as a consequence, that removes you from doubt. So Aseh lecha rav,
And by definition, you're going to be mistalek min ha-safek. You're not going to have a problem as to who do I follow, what do? Do I follow Beis Hillel? Do I follow Beis Shammai? We need to centralize. Finally, nonetheless, it was Rabbi Gamliel who said, do not accustom yourself to tithing by estimate. Tithing by estimate inevitably produces mistakes. When a person tithed too little produce, the tithes would be valid, but the remaining fruit would remain in the category of tevel, i.e. untithed, and hence prohibited. Tithing too much produce meant that while the fruit is ritually acceptable, it contains an element of chulin, that which is not sanctified. Rabbi Gamliel presented a solution to the problem of doubt and of mistakes, not by adopting the path of stringency, but rather by acquiring a teacher for yourself. So I'm not sure we're going to cover exactly. I know that if you're not familiar with tithes, etc., that last statement probably doesn't make a lot of sense, and we'd have to elaborate on it in more detail, which I'm going to hold off for now. And we're going to close with one more source, and I'm going to show you, direct you to another source if you want to look at it on your own. So the last source here is from a more classical commentator, the Medrash Shmuel, and I think it's a long source in Hebrew, and we're not going to go through the whole thing. I just want to sort of highlight what he says. I think what he says is similar to what Rabbi Lau says, and that is that you're at a time period where there's a lot of disputes. And because there's a lot of disputes, because of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, it's within that context that we need to remove ourselves from doubts. And he says, how do you remove yourself from doubt? This is a little bit different than Rabbi Lau. How do you remove yourself from doubt? So, Aselecha Rav means that, he argues, you should become a rabbi. Meaning that you should know enough yourself to be able to live your Jewish religious life, that you don't have to keep asking questions. It's good to ask questions when you don't know, but become learned so you can remove yourself from, oh, this rabbi says that rabbi, this and this, and blah, 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 etc. It's so confusing, I don't know who to follow. So learn the sugya, learn the sources, figure it out. And then with guidance, maybe you need to have somebody help you do that, but that's how he argues. Oh, wait, there's more, I think, important points that he makes, but we're going to leave it for now. I'm gonna take a deep breath and let it go. But he has some interesting stuff. The last source I'm just going to point you to is the bottom of that page. This is a tshuva from Rav Usher Weiss. Rav Usher Weiss is a contemporary posek, a huge rabbi now in Israel, has lots of great svarim. The reason why I'm quoting to you this tshuva he has is because of something that Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Twersky quotes in his commentary on Pirkei Avos. So he says, he connects this concept of suffix, of doubt, to the diagnosis of obsessive compulsive disorder. And he says that when it comes to somebody who suffers from OCD, from obsessive compulsive disorder, it's a large range of things that it could affect, and there's also a large scale as to how severe, you know, from mild to moderate to severe it can be. But one of the things that a lot of people with OCD, and even people, you know, who do not suffer from OCD, sometimes struggle with, is this concept of doubt. What if I'm not sure? What if I don't know for sure? And Rabbi Twersky says that this Mishnah is addressing this concept of histalik min ha-safek, remove yourself from doubt. By doing what? By aselecha rav, by creating a central person in your life who you can ask questions to. And the tshuva that I quoted to you here from Rav Usher Weiss is that, so if somebody has, somebody suffers from obsessive compulsive disorder, in a religious context, it's sometimes called scrupulosity, which means that if I say Shema, and there's a certain way that I have to say Shema, a certain kavana, it's pronunciation correctly. Right? There are halachas about this, that I have to do it in the proper way. Well, let's say I'm not positive I did it in the proper way. So if somebody who suffers from obsessive compulsive disorder could get very stuck in this cycle of, did I say it correctly? Did I not say it correctly? Did I wash my hands properly for Netilas Yadayim? Did I not wash my hands properly for Netilas Yadayim? Did I clean myself completely before I went to the mikvah, or did I not clean myself completely before I go to the mikvah? To be a little bit more gruesome, but it's important just in terms of the halachos as well as the case. Before I daven, I have to, let's say I go to the bathroom, I have to wipe myself properly, right? Did I do that properly enough? And you can have, people do get stuck in this Did I do it enough? One time, two times, three times, four times, five times. You can spend hours a day not sure if I perform this halacha correctly. So Rav Asher Weiss in this tshuva says, he was presented with the question of somebody with, what do we do about this religiously? Maybe the guy didn't fulfill the mitzvah. Maybe they weren't perfectly clean enough in order to go to the mikvah or wash the tefillos adayim or etc. or daven. So Rav Asher Weiss says, I'm just going to quote you the summary points here, that for somebody who has this mental illness, they follow their doctor in consultation with the rabbi, and the rabbis should follow the psak of the research here that says that the goal in therapy is don't go back to do it again. You do it once and you're done. Maybe try to be mindful about it, but as you do it, once you do it, you don't go back. And that's really hard. That creates a tremendous amount of anxiety when you are told not to go back, but that's what the treatment is. The treatment is don't go back. Don't do it again. Don't try to reassure yourself that I'm going to do it now the next time properly. So Rav Asher Weiss says that's the treatment. That's what you do. Whether or not you fulfilled the mitzvah, didn't fulfill the mitzvah, is irrelevant. The mitzvah for you at this point in time is to get better. And therefore, you listen to the Aseh Lecha Rav, you listen to the rabbi, you listen to the psychologist, in order to, histolik min hasafik, to remove yourself from the debt. Rely on them, and don't get caught up in the debt. Now, this is obviously much harder to do, and this takes time, and this takes treatment, etc. But I just thought it was interesting that Rabbi Tversky uses this Mishnah to segue into this. He himself doesn't quote Rav Asher Weiss. I'm just familiar with this tshuva from other sources. And it's a fascinating way of reading. Big picture for us. Well,
if you're not sure if you said a bracha or not, you should not say it again, right?
If you're not sure if you said a bracha or not, that's suffik bracha sahaka. There are rules, with not in the context of OCD, of whether or not you go back or not, right? So if it's a suffik d'oraisa, l'chumra suffik d'rabbanan l'kula. So if there's a rabbinic thing that I'm not sure if I did, I don't do it again. If there's a biblical thing that I'm not sure I did, I do it again. Here, the ruling, I believe, and we have to read it more carefully, but I think the ruling is even on a biblical idea, if you're not sure. If you have OCD, you shouldn't go back. If you don't, then again, I'm not sure if I benched or not, so that's biblical, you should recite it again. Or again, it would be the first time, perhaps. But if you suffer from this mental illness, then I think the psak, the mitzvah for you at that point in time is to try and not go back. Just summing up, and we'll take questions in a moment. Big picture here, we didn't do a lot of the other meforshim on this Mishnah. We sort of stuck with the Mahalach, with the direction of Rabbi Lau, and then just a little bit at the end with the OCD. But the big picture here to understand Rabbi Gamliel is that it's authority plus innovation. In order for the Chazal, in order for the sages, in order for the Tanaim, to now move, keep in mind the historical context here, we're moving from Rabbi Gamliel, we're going to be moving to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, and then we're going to get to post-destruction. How do you, as we spoke about on Tisha B'Av, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, how do you move past, forward, how do you move forward after the destruction of the temple? You need strong leaders who are able to adapt to the time within the system, but they can't be afraid to say, oh, my Rebbe didn't do that. Right? Your Rebbe wasn't alive now. Your Rebbe wouldn't know exactly how this time period is going about that we need to change and make adaptations for. So you have this centralized authority building. This is going to help us as we move forward past the destruction, as well as the ability and the demand to innovate and to create that is also going to move us past and forward to the destruction. We're going to see this in Rabbi Akiva. We're going to see this down the line. But this is another recurring theme that we've seen in the past and will see in the future, and at least for now, helped us understand Rabbi Gamliel. We'll take a few questions and then back.